You usually do the intro. Do you want me to do the intro?
And welcome back to the Bug in a Rug podcast. As always, my name is Caitlin.
As usual, I'm Whitney.
And we are here once again on this lovely, lovely day. Well, this evening. To bring, you know, a story that might keep you up at night.
Have you ever been so full of food that you feel like your eyes are going to fall out?
Not my eyes, I don't think.
I don't know. My belly's really, really full, and my eyes feel like they're just pushing out of my head just a little bit.
Y'all right? Do you still think you can record?
I mean, I think so, but if my eyes fall out, I want you to know that it was the Mexican food that did it.
You just can't stop eating it. It's so good.
I did stop, though. I had a whole other quesadilla that I had ordered that I brought home.
For lunch tomorrow. Yeah. Now, that's what I call,
a pocket snack?
No.
Music volume 10?
Food prepping.
Meal prep, yes.
Meal prepping. You just get
these leftovers from Mexican restaurants. Mary Beth told me, my coordinator told me to make sure I take lots of snacks for tomorrow when I start my new rotation and to fill my pockets with snacks. And I think I'm just going to stick that quesadilla right down in there.
Yeah, it's fine. I think if you fold it in half, it'll fit.
It's already folded in half once.
Yeah, well, fold it half again. Oh, my God. This little it's already folded in half once. It's not funny.
I thought it was funny. But I might cut it in half. I don't think I need a whole quesadilla. Anyway.
Nah, probably not.
As always, if you hear any jingle jangles, scritchy scratches, or pitter-pattering in the background, we do have cats, and they do like to be involved in the podcast process.
Yeah, we have a fish too, but he doesn't get that involved.
He doesn't. I wish we could get him more involved.
Yeah.
Greg should be more involved in the podcast.
You want me to bring him out here and sit him next to the microphone?
I kind of feel like he should be out here while we record.
His tank's really heavy, though, and I'd have to plug it in, and I just don't want to do that.
I think you should take him out and put him in a small container for while we record.
No, why like would I do that? Absolutely not.
It's a field trip for Greg.
Absolutely not. Why would I put him? I put him in a small container to change his water, and he is not a happy boy.
He needs a travel tank.
I mean, I have a smaller one, but
what would you do if the building caught on fire? What would you do with Greg?
I would grab his whole tank. What are you talking about?
You said it's heavy.
Yeah, but like I would, Whitney. Sorry, I'm making tea, so if you hear any...
Like little crinkles.
Why would I leave him behind, though?
No, you wouldn't. I'm saying you should have a travel container ready at all times.
Yeah, but then I'd have to, like, get him into it, and he swims away from other containers. So, like, how would I do that?
Practice.
We're gonna have practice...
Fire drills.
Fire drills.
With Greg.
Okay.
He's in water. Wouldn't he be okay?
No, because the container would melt.
Would it?
It's plastic.
I mean, I don't know.
Okay. Well, I do have, you know, if there's a fire, like, in the hallway, I do have that fire ladder that you can, like, put out the window and climb down.
Is it here? We have one?
Yeah, it's in my closet.
Oh, I thought it was at home.
I told Mom and Dad that if there's a fire in their house, they could get out because they could just crawl onto, like, the...
The porch roof.
The porch roof.
Right outside their bedroom.
Right. Window. But then I was like... I think I need it because I'd be in more danger. Okay, quit stepping there.
Is his box, can he get in the box?
Yes.
He likes the microphone, the box we put the microphone in. Cooper thinks is his home while we record.
Yeah.
There he goes. Aw, settle down, buddy.
Okay. But anyway, yes, it's here. It's in my closet, so if we ever need it.
Hey.
But how would I carry Greg down the ladder?
That's what I'm saying. You need a... backpack-sized travel container for Greg.
That is a backpack.
Oh, you could get one of those bubble backpacks and just, like, dump him in there.
I don't think those seal, though.
You need a sealable backpack. You can just dump him in there.
Yeah. We'll figure it out.
Anyway, segues are cool.
Yeah.
We were just talking about if there's a fire here, and our story today is about fires.
Ooh, okay. More than
totally one. Totally unintentional, but I realized halfway through us talking about how to get Greg out of a fire. We need to have a fire
drill.
How would
you get cats?
I'm getting really concerned.
How would you get the cats out?
They're...
Okay, you're gonna... How? Crawl under my bed to get Ellie? Like, I don't... I mean, my bed moves really easily, so you could probably get her.
We're having a fire drill once we're done with this podcast. I'm not kidding.
Everyone... Do you remember when we were, like, in kindergarten or whatever, we had to bring that piece of paper home that, like, whenever emergency stuff?
Yeah.
And it was, like, what happens if in a fire? What do you do? And you do with your parents? And, like, if something happens, like, where do you meet your parents?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Who would you go to?
We go to Pop's basement.
Yeah.
But how would you... One time, there was a tornado warning, and Mom and Dad were running around trying to get things to take us up to the basement, and then they were trying to find us, but we were gone. Because our uncle had come down, picked us up one under each arm, and ran up to the basement with us, and, like, didn't tell Mom and Dad.
Right.
So they, like, didn't know where we were.
At the time, what, I was, like...
Teeny. We were so
one.
Small. Yeah, we were real little.
So, anyway, fires.
Fires! I want to talk about an episode of Forensic Files that we saw.
Ooh.
It was one that really caught my attention because I don't think that it's very well known, but I think that it should be.
It's interesting.
It was really interesting, and also we have friends who are from this area. We're going to be talking about L.A. County, California, the Glendale area specifically in this story, and we have friends from college, Genesis, but they've lived near this area.
Yeah.
So I would be interested to see, you know, if their parents remember any of this.
Yeah, true. Well, it depends on where they were at the time. Because like I said, they've both moved a few times. Yeah.
But anyway, our story takes place in L.A. County, California, and begins in 1984.
Oof.
So, L.A. City, or L.A. County, is in southwestern California. It's one day and 9 hours from where we are now. Driving straight.
Oh.
Yes, I decided to Google that because I've done that on one of our episodes before, and I just think it's interesting that if we were to start now and drive there, it would take us one day and 9 hours.
I mean, we are the opposite
33
of the country,
hours.
So.
Yes. So, L.A. County houses Glendale, Pasadena, Burbank, and several other cities, smaller cities.
Yeah.
Fresno and Tulare are north of Bakersville, California, and they're all in the same area. So these are cities that will be part of our story, so I just want you to keep them in mind. This is the area we're talking about.
Okay.
So the first incident that I'm going to tell you about is from October 10th, 1984.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first...
Oh, God, sorry. The cat tried to jump on the table, but I moved at the same time, and he almost fell off the table because I hit him as he was jumping up.
He's excited because this story is going to be a hot one.
Will you get... Come here.
I'm going to have to tell my joke again.
Story's going to be a hot one. I heard ya.
So, on October 10th, 1984, in South Pasadena, California, which is in L.A. County, Jim Obdam, O-B-D-A-M, was 19 years old at the time, and he was working as a cashier at a Ole's Home Center. This is kind of like a craft store or home goods store.
Yeah.
It's kind of a catch-all. They have craft things, but they also have food and hardware and different things like that from what I could find.
Yeah.
So it was kind of quiet that evening because the World Series was on, so mm-hmm. a lot of people were watching that.
Yeah, at home.
That
nobody's crafting during the World Series.
Nobody's out. They were wanting to watch it. I think
I would have been crafting during the World Series.
I don't know what L.A. team is baseball.
L.A. Los Angeles Angels.
A lot of people were watching the World Series at this time, as he could remember, so there weren't many people in the store, but there were a few people here and there. Like, not everyone watches baseball. We don't watch baseball.
I'd be crafting instead of watching. I mean, nothing against baseball. I just don't.
We just don't follow it. Jim Obdam, our first person we're talking about, Mr. Yeah. Obdam, walked towards the back of the store and noticed that there was some smoke coming from the hardware section, like crafting section of the store.
Okay.
And he started trying to lead customers towards the front entrance.
Right.
The lights went out and they had a hard time trying to see which way they were going, and they were all trying to find the fire exit.
Yeah.
He actually made it out alive, And a quote from him was that he, quote, still remembers as soon as he got out of the store, he touched his arm and the skin just fell off of it.
Ew.
So this was a really bad fire. When fire department got on the scene, the whole store was basically enveloped in flames and smoke. I went in looking for, trying to figure out what degree burn he would have had, how severe his burn would be if his skin just fell off of it.
Third, probably, right?
Well, so it's kind of hard to tell. And also, I don't know how many people know this, but the burn classification system has changed.
Oh.
So instead of saying first, second, third degree burns right now, they say superficial skin burns, which were previously first degree burns and only involve the top of the skin. These are usually dry, red, and when you press on them, they blanch or they turn white. So that means the blood supply to them is still active.
No, you're driving me nuts, boy. Driving me nuts.
Cooper's very interested in this story.
I don't know what he wants. Here.
So the next category is superficial partial thickness burns, which were previously secondary burns. These involve the top two layers of the skin and are painful when they are touched by air or if the air temperature changes. They are red and they seep fluids. So they kind of get weepy and have blisters. They still turn white when they're pressed, though.
Okay.
Sunburns that blister after several hours are a good example of this category.
Okay.
So the third category is a deep partial thickness burn. So we had superficial partial thickness and now deep partial thickness. This used to be third degree burns. So they extend deeper into the skin. They're painful with deep pressure. They almost always blister. Mm-hmm. So that's how you would tell for sure. And they do not blanch. So the blood supply has already been burned so that you can't make them turn white and then red again.
Right. Okay.
They,
I'm not a doctor, but that just seems way more confusing to have to say in an emergency than like
first, second, or third degree. Right. You know what I mean? Agree. But so some of the resources that I saw said that Mr. Obdam had a second degree burn, but the deep partial thickness or third degree burns, they blister almost immediately after occurring.
Yeah.
Whereas the other one can take some time.
Right.
And once they blister, that's when your skin starts to peel. So I'm thinking he probably had that. As opposed
it was quicker.
Right. Because the last category is a full thickness burn, and it completely destroys your skin, and it won't be painful at all. Which he might have had between a third and a fourth degree burn, but they require surgical treatment, and this is where, you know, you're going to involve all layers of your skin. It might be down to the bone. Like, it's going to be very, very severe.
Right.
So I'm thinking he probably had a third degree burn, maybe towards fourth, which would be deep partial thickness to full thickness.
Yeah.
I know that's a little confusing, but I think that it was interesting for me that they've changed the classification recently.
For sure.
So that before, where we'd say for a second or third degree or fourth degree.
Yeah.
It's changed. So anyway, Mr. Obdam, he made it out alive, and almost everyone was able to escape, but there were four fatalities due to this fire. 2-year-old Matthew Tridle and his grandmother, Ada Deal, who was 50, and two employees, Carolyn Krause, age 26, and a 17-year-old named Jenny Satina. This was really sad. I mean, there's four people that died. Mr. Obdam was very lucky to have gotten out of the store when he did, and he was able to help a lot of customers get out.
Right.
Probably could have been a lot worse if the World Series hadn't been on and people were out and about and not watching the game. But this was a really big fire. It caused a lot of damage.
Did the lights go out because the fire got too bad?
It probably burned the electrical wires. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
The whole building was engulfed, so I'm assuming that it was because
the fire got too big.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, Marvin Casey, an arson investigator, was one of several arson investigators who was called to the scene. He was looking for a point of origin for this fire to try and figure out, you know, was this an accident or was it done on purpose?
Right, because that'd be like, was it an electrical thing? Did it start in the electrical box or was it in the fabric row where there's nothing that should necessarily catch on fire?
Exactly, and this is the kind of thing that happens all the time. They want to be able to figure out, did somebody do this or was it an accident? How do we prevent it from happening
again? Well, it's for, I mean, even if nobody dies in the fire, it's for insurance purposes too, I'm sure, right? Because if you own something and it catches on fire, you'll have to know why, because insurance will want to know.
Absolutely. This happens with basically any structural fire or any fire that emergency responders are called to.
Hey, did you hear that? My she shed's covered.
So, Marvin Casey, that's a name I want you to remember, because he is probably my favorite person in this story.
Marvin Casey.
So, he said that as he was looking for the point of origin for this fire, it was extremely hard to do, because basically by the time that the firefighters come in here...
It's so bad.
Well, yeah, and plus once the firefighters have come in, everything's soaked.
Yeah.
So, you basically have water and piles of trash, because that's all that's left after everything's burned. Officially, they had to rule the fire an accident, because they could not find any point of origin or point of starting.
Well, it was about as you said, I'm sure the whole thing came down, and... then you can't see anything. So.
Right. It was just, I mean, a heap of rubble, basically. John Orr, O-R-R, another arson investigator, was really frustrated with Marvin Casey's report. He said he disagreed with what he said, and that he was on the scene when the fire started and took pictures and expressed to the family of the victims that he thought it was arson, even though that's not the official report. He kept saying how frustrated he was, and he said, I bet that it was started in those patio cushions that are made of polyurethane foam.
Okay.
He was adamant about it, but they couldn't. There was not enough evidence left to say that, but he said, you didn't do a good enough job. This is what happened. It was strange. Yeah, so, interesting,
Interesting, okay.
So, 2 months later... around December 1984, there was a second fire at another Ollie's store.
Okay. Same type of store?
Same type of store. Same chain. Same area-ish. This was in Bakersfield. I think it was near Bakersfield, California.
Okay.
So same area. This one was ruled an arson for sure. And it started in the foam padding section.
Right.
These are polyurethane foam sheets, like in the crafting section.
Right.
I'm not sure what all you would use those for, but...
And those are the types of things you would probably put, like, for cushions and stuff, right?
Yes. You could cover them and make
cushions. Or, like, redo your chairs and stuff with this type of foam, depending on how thick you want it.
Yes. Polyurethane is very, very flammable. I didn't look up the chemical structure. I mean, I don't think it's that important, but...
I think everything in a craft store is pretty flammable. You know what I mean? Like...
Yes. This specifically
I'm sure.
Not surprising that if it started here, it was going to be...
Catch on fire quick. Yeah.
In Bakersfield, California, there were more store fires around the same time. One at a craft mart. Again, you know, craft store, obviously. Right. Fabric, fake flowers, and foam. In this section, they believe, is where this fire started.
Mm-hmm.
Marvin Casey was back on the scene. He was called to the scene as an investigator. He was looking in a bin of flowers when he found... what he called an incendiary device, which is what would be used to start a fire if this was in fact arson, which this was.
Sure. Yes.
So I guess like incinerate, but incendiary.
Yeah.
It's just hard for me to say.
Right.
We don't pretend to know how to pronounce things on this podcast.
No, not at all.
So this incendiary device was a yellow lined paper wrapped around three matches with a cigarette in the middle.
Okay.
So this was an extended release device.
Right.
So you would light the cigarette, and as it burned down, eventually it would get to the matches, which would light the matches and light the paper, and then light what was around it.
Yeah. And then if you put in the foam section, the foam's really easy to catch on fire, so it would just go up in flames.
Yes. So the idea is this gives the arsonist time to get away so they're not seen in the store at the time of the fire.
Right.
And they're not put in
harm's way. Or get stuck. Yeah, it's like get stuck in the store.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they did find this device, which is the first one that they found like it, even though they were able to say the other ones were arson.
Yeah.
Because of where they were located, they weren't able to recover a device before.
Well, I mean, those things are also really easy that if the fire was hot enough, it would probably just burn them up.
Right. Or it's so small, it's going to be lost in all the rubble.
Yeah.
The same day, another fabric store in the same area also caught on fire.
Okay. This is just two, right?
This is two in the same day.
Right. But same area as Bakersfield.
Same area as Bakersfield. There were several that were going on, but these are two in the same day.
Okay.
Across town, there was another fire. Marvin Casey was called to the scene again, and he said a bin holding pillows and foam was the origin of this fire as well.
Okay, so same place, essentially.
Basically the same
foam area. Ammo. Yeah. Craft store.
Mode of operation. Is that what ammo stands for? If you watch crime shows, you know what I mean. So Marvin Casey said, quote, "It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that we have a fire bug on the loose."
Yeah, really. And because, I mean, how many different people are going to set craft stores on fire? You know what I mean?
Right, because it's been all craft stores.
Because I feel like most arsonists are out for, what, insurance purposes to collect? Or they don't like somebody, so they catch their stuff on fire? Mm-hmm. Like, unless, like, a group of people really hate craft stores. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's gotta be the same person. Like, why?
Yeah, it's the same MO. Within the upcoming days, weeks, months, I'm not sure what the time frame was for this, there were more fires north of Bakersfield in Fresno and Tulare.
Mm-hmm.
They're all in the same area. They found identical incendiary devices at one of these fires. So mm-hmm. It's the same yellow paper
right.
with the matches and the cigarette.
Yeah.
Same type of area of the store
mm-hmm.
in some kind of cushions or pillows. And the investigators are starting to realize they have this problem and nicknamed the arsonist that they were chasing the Pillow Pyro.
That's stupid.
I think it is too, but that's what they called him.
The Pillow Pyro.
The Pillow Pyro.
Every time someone says pyro, I think they're going to say pirate, and then I think I get disappointed that it's not. Does that make sense?
Pirates are very exciting. I totally understand.
Yeah.
So, we've had several fires up to this point on the same area.
Yeah.
Within a short amount of time.
Right.
And
October to December.
October to December and beyond.
Right.
Fresno and Tulare were a little bit after that, but I don't know exactly.
Still, same year in a couple months.
Exactly. Span. Yes. The entire story that we're going to talk about takes place in the 80s, late 80s to the early 90s, so it's all in this time frame.
Yeah.
So, not to worry, though. Marvin's on the case.
Yeah.
Marvin Casey is on the casey.
Okay, guys, that's the end of the podcast. I can't do this anymore.
You have to. We're only halfway.
Okay.
So, Marvin is on the case. He started putting together a map of where all these fires had taken place that mm-hmm. had similar MOs.
Right.
They all happened
MO,
to be...
I looked it up. Mode of operating. You're right.
Mode of operating. So, the same way that these fires were started.
Yeah.
Same targets, all of that. He said that when he plotted these, they were all along Route 99 and all along the same time. That there was, in fact, an arsonist investigator convention happening in Fresno.
Ooh. Okay.
This was a big red flag to him.
Yeah.
So, it was extremely strange, obviously. There were 300 people at the convention, and so Marvin took a list of these names, and he wrote down who would have had to driven along Route 99
right.
from Bakersfield down to Fresno.
Okay.
So that's kind of like the path that the fires would have taken.
Okay. But what fires were these? Like, I know he's mapping out all of them, but it didn't take them 4 months to drive to this convention.
No, but the convention's happening over maybe a week's time. I'm not sure exactly how many days. And there was a stretch of time where
there was a bunch of fires in
the
1 week.
Two in 1 day.
Right, right. Okay,
and
okay,
a couple
okay, okay,
in Bakersfield before that.
Yeah.
So this is all in 1 week.
Okay.
All the same time as the convention. So he
that
took all the ones that happened during the convention.
Mapped them out.
And then he took the people that were there and said, okay, who would have had to drive from
where
here to here?
Is there... Yeah, where
right.
are they placed, and then, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who drove here alone.
Yeah.
And...
How do you know that?
I
just asked.
Talking to different people.
Yeah.
Who would have driven there, not, like, carpooled with different people.
Oh, and they didn't come as a department, they came by themselves.
By themselves.
Yeah.
Right. So he narrowed the list of 300 people down to 55 people.
Okay.
These are people who traveled alone, attended the conference, and passed through Bakersfield down Route 99
okay.
to Fresno.
Right.
So they would have traveled the route of all the fires.
Yes. Now he has to find out who hates crafts.
Who hates crafts?
Who hate? Really, though? Who hates crafting?
Somebody.
There's a craft out there for everybody.
Anyway, so he takes this to his superiors. Marvin Casey takes this to his superiors and the other investigators whom he trusts who wouldn't have been on this list. Okay. And they...
He's like, what do you think? And somebody's on it.
They're like, I don't know. But they ignored him. Mm. They were like, you're crazy. Why would an arson investigator be starting arson fires? This is a coincidence.
Well, let's see. Let's brainstorm. I almost forgot the word brainstorm. Let's brain think about it.
My eyes still feel like tacos are going to come out.
An arson investigator that would set fires could be doing it. Didn't we have one already? A guy, didn't we talk about a story already about like hero complex?
Mm-hmm.
So it could be hero complex.
That's what they thought Richard Jewell had.
That's right. That's right. They could just be mad for some reason, got demoted, missed a promotion. You know what I mean?
So for people who don't know or haven't listened to the Richard Jewell episode, go listen to it.
Yes.
But several of the reasons that they thought he could have been guilty for planting a bomb was that he
had hero complex.
Had a hero complex. So he planted it and then he was the first one on the scene.
To save people.
To save people. Not true. He didn't plant it. I just want to keep reiterating that.
Yeah.
And also, he had been knocked down. He wanted to be a police officer. He couldn't be a police officer. He kept getting demoted to a security guard.
Right.
And so that was another reason against him.
Right. So this guy could have wanted to be the first one on the scene to, you know, help people get out of the fire or whatever. And then also he didn't get the raise that he wanted or something. I don't know, but, you know.
So these are different things that they were thinking.
I don't know how firefighters' salaries work, so.
Depends on the district.
Okay.
Depends on the area.
Yeah.
Because some people, like, back home, they're volunteers.
Yeah. Yes.
But places like L.A. County, where there's
some people get paid, because, like, I don't know. Continue.
Some people do. But places like L.A. County, where there's so many fires, this is something that I'm sure tax dollars go to.
Yeah, pay for.
So they get paid. Anyway, so...
But they didn't believe him.
Nobody believed him, but he went ahead and sent the incendiary device from the Craft Mart to the ATF, or the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Association. For some reason, they're in charge of fires, as well as alcohol, tobacco, and firearms.
Okay.
Maybe that's why they don't say alcohol, tobacco, and guns. Because I gotta get fire. They gotta sneak fire in there.
Firearms, which could mean guns, or it could mean like
people who set fire with their arms.
Yeah.
Magicians. No.
And got him.
Got him. So, the ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and fire things. Fire stuff.
Yes.
That's where they say.
And fire shenanigans.
And fire shenanigans, including guns.
Yes.
That's the separate clause.
And fire, etc.
I don't know why they're in charge, but they are. We've just explained it. It's fine. Anyway, so he sends this to... Marvin Casey sends this incendiary device to the ATF.
To the ATF, which we've already said.
Right, but now I keep forgetting because now I'm off on a tangent about what the F should stand for.
Okay, go.
So this is the yellow paper, three matches, and a cigarette.
Okay. The one that... All of them or just, like, one specific one that he found?
He used the one from Craft Mart because it was...
The most intact.
The first one that they found.
Okay.
And the most intact, yes.
Okay.
They had other ones, but they sent this one because it was, I believe, the most intact.
Right.
Or he had access to it.
Okay.
So the scientists at the ATF used ninhydrin, which is a liquid chemical and reacts to amino acids that make up fingerprint residue or skin cells. Fingerprint residue is most likely skin cells. Or like oils from your finger.
Oils.
So dirt. This liquid... This chemical reacts to those, and whenever you let it dry then, which could take a day, these scientists, like, used an air dryer or, like, a blow dryer or something, and then whenever you brush it with powder,
the skin cells will show up in the powder. The powder will stick to the skin cells.
Yes.
I'm having a really hard time
with explaining this process.
You know what's wild to me, though? Like, you know how they kind of show it, that kind of stuff in forensic files? How this stuff, when you put, like, paper in it or whatever, that the paper doesn't just, like, dissolve. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not soluble in that.
Right.
No, this is more, like, to stick to the skin cells. It, like, adheres to it, and then the powder adheres
to it. Like a liquid glue.
Yeah. So, I don't know how much you guys watch forensic files or case files or murder stuff, but anytime there's duct tape, they like to use super glue that has been liquefied, and then they like steam it onto the paper somehow, and then when it dries, it sticks to the fingerprints so that you can see
where the
print was. Yeah, they use like aerosolized super glue. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is what they used, and they found a partial print.
Dun dun dun.
Dun dun dun.
Whose print was it?
Well,
hey Winnie, whose print was it?
Hey, you didn't let me get there. So they photographed this partial print with a special filter to make the ridge detail stand out against the yellow background.
Okay.
For some reason, they had trouble seeing it, so they're like, okay, we'll just use this filter.
Well, on paper, I guess.
Like, I think the lines in the paper, yeah, and it was only partial print and wasn't a full one, so small. It was kind of hard to see. Mm-hmm. And the incendiary device is very small.
Yeah.
So, they entered this into AFIS, which is the Criminal Fingerprint Database. Anytime you're convicted of a crime, you have to put your fingerprints into AFIS.
But that's not who they thought he was.
That's not who Marvin Casey thought it was going to be. Yeah. And you'd have to be convicted of a crime in order to have your fingerprints in the system.
Yep.
So, yes. No match, obviously.
Yeah.
Because that's not who we're looking for.
Yeah.
We're who Marvin Casey was looking
for. That's not who we are looking for.
I am part of this team, damn it.
It's us and Marvin Casey.
I wish. So, Marvin's like, okay, well, that was my plan anyway, so I would like to compare this to the 55 people mm-hmm. who I had narrowed the list down of before. He was denied.
Yeah, would they have to get everybody's fingerprints? They don't already have them, do they?
So, they do in some cases, but we'll get to that.
Okay.
But he was denied because they said it was too many people to try and dig up their prints. But in my mind, I'm like, how many fires are you going to let happen?
Yeah, that's true. Like, yes, I mean, it is 55 people, but still, that's a lot to just let go. Like, fires.
No, without... I agree. I don't know how many there had been at this point, because there's not really a tally during this time. But we have at least 5 or 6.
Right.
And we have 4 people that have died.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, like, how much more
are you
going to let happen?
Mm-hmm.
So... this kind of case goes cold a little bit. Right. I mean, there's other fires, but they're not really able to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
2 years later, along Highway 101, there was a stretch of fires that, again, spanned the length of this highway.
Okay.
Can you guess what else this had in common with the previous fires?
Craft stores.
And...
An arson convention.
Exactly.
Arson investigator convention. All arsonists come to California.
What a trap. What a honeypot that would be.
What a trap.
That's a honeypot for sure, right?
I don't think any. No smart arsonist would go to that.
But yes, so this was
an arson convention.
The arson convention was
an arson investigator convention.
Sorry, the arson investigator convention was along Highway 101 in the same area, and there were more fires in this area that stretched. And so Marvin was like, Hey guys, I'm gonna take this list,
right?
55.
Yeah,
and I'm gonna see who attended both conferences,
right?
So, he got 10 names.
Ooh, really?
And he's like, a booyah. So, he's like, well, is this few enough people that you'll let me do it?
Yeah.
And they sent it to their superiors, and they looked at the fingerprints, and they were like, no result.
What?
Yeah, I know. Marvin's like, are you kidding me?
Did they check?
Mm-hmm. They said they looked at it. Nobody was a result.
Okay, so...
You as frustrated as I am?
Now I'm just
We
like...
worked so hard on this. We attended so many arson conventions to try and lure out the arsonist. Anyway, 2 more years go by.
Oof.
And at this time, you know, dozens of fires sprout up. Dozens of stores. Millions and millions of dollars worth of damage.
Well, yeah.
And finally, a special agent with the ATF gets put on the case.
Okay.
Because they're like, this is too similar. There's too much going on. We got to draw the line. So this is Michael Matassa. Matassa. M-A-T-A-S-S-A.
Okay.
So Special Agent Matassa, as I'm going to call him, because it says he's a special agent with the ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and fire stuffs.
Fire, etc.
Fire, etc. ATF, lowercase e. He gets in on the scene and is saying, okay, so our MO here is somebody that starts fires in businesses during open hours.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Michael? I'd like to add that it's craft stores.
Yeah.
And also, we have specific incendiary devices.
Yeah.
And also, it's all along the same route.
Yeah.
And all of these things. And this is when Mr. Matassa learns of Marvin's theory.
Right.
Which is basically everything I just said.
And right.
And he's like, oh.
Well, yeah, why not start with those people first as suspects? You know what I mean?
Like, right. Well, so it's up till this point.
Unless it's somebody who isn't an arson investigator, but has something against one of them, so is starting fires in, like, a way to be like, ha, 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 like,
yeah,
you're at this big convention, but look at all the fires I'm starting.
Yeah, you know calls, I mean? Calls them out of the convention to go investigate.
Right, but even then, if you talk to these people, you can be like, do you have anybody that has anything against you? Mm-hmm. And then you could go from there, too.
Right. Well, see, up to this point, people are kind of just laughing at Mr. Casey, Marvin yeah. Casey, and just like, dude, what are you talking about? Like,
right.
Clearly, that's not happening because your fingerprint didn't match.
Mm-hmm.
And Matassa's like, it actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Maybe we should relook at this. So, when he learned about Marvin's theory and went and talked to him, he sounds like Newton's law. Marvin's theory.
Yeah. Marvin's theory.
So anyway, he learned about this, and he went to the LA County Sheriff's Office and okay. asked to compare the data of the partial print to their database of anyone who ever applied for a job. So they keep a collection of fingerprints of anybody who's ever applied for a job as a police officer, and I believe as a firefighter as well.
Okay.
So, and it's anyone who's ever applied, not just the people who are currently.
Well, because you'd have to submit, like, your background information, right? So that would take part of, mm-hmm. be, like, part of it.
Yes. And I think probably the arson investigators are also on file. But this yeah, is just a little bit wider. Yeah,
started as, like,
net.
Firefighters, though.
Yeah. So this is, that's a little bit wider
yeah.
than before. And they got a match.
Ooh.
Now, the funny thing about this match, before I tell you who it is that this person was on the list of 10 people.
Of course he was.
When they compared, for some reason, they didn't get a match before when they looked. And what I'm thinking is they had fingerprints from arson investigators and the prints just weren't good enough comparison.
Yeah.
Whereas when they looked back, this person had applied for jobs at a police officer and as a firefighter in a couple different things, so they have multiple sets, and I think when they were able to look at it,
hit a match,
they could compare multiple ones and had a more distinct comparison.
Didn't they even check it the first time?
I don't know. I think they kind of laughed him off, and I don't know how serious they were yeah. about it, which kind of makes me mad. But we have a match now.
Okay.
This matched this print.
On don't the tell me it's Marvin Casey.
No, my heart would be broken.
Okay, I'm ready.
This print matched the left ring finger of John Orr.
Mm.
Now, if you remember, John Orr, at the beginning of our story, is the one who was adamant that the first fire at the Ole's home
was
store
arson.
Was arson, and even told the families that he thought it being ruled an accident was ridiculous because
right.
he was sure it was arson.
Why would he say that, though?
So,
does he have slight hero complex?
I think that he thought he was better than all the other arson investigators.
Right.
He, a little bit about his background that I think makes it yeah. make a little more sense.
Okay.
John Orr wanted to be a police officer and applied in 1981, but he didn't pass the psych test.
Okay.
So his mind wasn't, he wasn't mentally
stable enough
to.
And whatever reason, for whatever reason.
For whatever reason. I don't know the details of that.
Right.
He applied to the fire department in LA County.
Okay.
And he failed the physical part of the training.
Okay.
So he wasn't in shape enough.
Okay.
So then he did some odd jobs here and there, and eventually he got on as a firefighter at the Glendale Fire Department. So Glendale is in LA County, but it's the lowest paying fire department
okay.
in the county.
Okay.
He was very frustrated with this. He thought he was better than that, and he should be higher up in the ranks. He eventually rose through the levels to become an arson investigator and then a captain of the Glendale Fire Department.
Okay.
He was, like I said, on the list of the 10 people who had been attending, who had attended both conventions. So, good job, Marvin Casey. You
yeah.
knew what was up.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem was finding this partial print only linked him to one fire.
Right.
Matassa, the special agent for the ATF, wanted to link him to more before they made an arrest.
Yeah, because it'd be like, well, I don't know. Would double jeopardy apply here if they, like, charged him for that one and then found evidence to charge him for... Or are they just getting a whole bunch of evidence so it sticks?
So, if you charge them for one and you're only charging them for one, that's fine. Double jeopardy would be you charge them for multiple but only have evidence in one.
They get off and then you try to do it again.
And then you try and charge them again.
Right.
So, I think they just wanted to be able to have a higher... More charges against him.
Yeah, higher probability to make him get convicted of something.
Of multiple crimes. Yeah. Right. And they didn't have enough evidence to convict him of the fire where the four people died.
Oh, that's right, because that wasn't the one where they found the incendiary device.
Right, that was in the Kraft Mart,
yeah.
Whereas the four people who died were the first fire in 1984.
Was at Ollie's.
Right,
yes. Exactly. Okay, got it.
Okay, so they have a plan, though. Matassa wants to start surveillance on Mr. Orr.
Okay.
And they used the latest in surveillance technology as of 1990,
1991. They hid in trash cans outside his house.
Nope. They tracked him using a system called Teletrack, which is it's about the size of a VCR tape.
Okay.
And you can put it anywhere on or in a car.
Okay.
But it uses cell phone towers to transmit a location.
Okay.
This was better than some of the other devices of the time where you had to have the car out in the open where you had direct range between the car and the tower. You had to have a straight line and couldn't be inside where you couldn't see the sky, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
This was different. You could transmit even within a garage.
Okay.
So it was better than the satellite GPS of the time.
Could you imagine, the person's job it was to put that on his car, though? He goes in to, Walmart or whatever to pick up a few groceries, and they're like, go, 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 go.
Go, 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 go.
You got 5 minutes to attach this to his car. It's terrifying.
You gotta have someone who's a lookout.
Yeah.
You got someone tailing him in the store.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure this was a whole big...
Yeah.
I'd love to see the notes of this specific mission to put this teletrack on his car.
Scary.
Yes. So on November 2nd of 1991 at 3:30 p.m., the teletrack placed Mr. Orr near the Warner Brothers studio in Burbank, California. Kind of strange because at the same time, a fire breaks out on the set of a show at Warner Brothers studio.
My God, he got on the set?
Or the back door or something like that.
Wow, okay.
Well, I mean, he's an arson investigator. He's got credentials, I'm sure.
True.
So, anyway, after the fire broke out, or prior to it being called in, Mr. Orr drove home.
Okay.
The 911 call went out, and dispatch called, the fire department and everybody and said, hey, here's the address for the fire.
Yes.
Because they called them. It's like, fire at this place. We need responders here.
Right.
The dispatcher accidentally gave the wrong location. They, said the wrong address.
Yeah, one number off.
Right, which was funny because Mr. Orr drove to the place where the fire actually was.
What a dummy.
What a dummy. But by the time he got there and realized there was no first responders there, he drove back to where they were called to, and then when everybody got sent to the right location, he came back.
Oh, boy.
This mistake being shown on the teletrack was enough to get a warrant.
Yeah, for sure. Because how would he know?
Right, how would he know where to actually go for the fire if the dispatcher who called him to tell him where to be...
Yeah, didn't tell him there.
Right. And they said this was inadvertent, that the dispatcher didn't mean to give the wrong location, but I feel like I would have told him the wrong location on purpose. This would have helped.
Well, it also could have been if somebody's running... calling 911 and running out, and they're like, there's a fire at 725... whatever, but everybody's yelling to get out of the building.
And they could have the wrong, or they could say the wrong address
because
they're confused
and
in a panic.
I'm sure it happens.
Anyway, this information was enough for a search warrant.
Right.
Woo! Now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah, we are.
We've worked hard for this.
Yeah, I feel validated.
I know, I'm excited. So a search of Mr. Orr's home revealed a briefcase with yellow lined papers, cigarettes, and matches inside.
Just that.
Mr. Orr said he has never set an arson fire except in training exercises, and
he likes to take a lot of notes, and he lights his cigarettes with matches.
He always carries that briefcase. It's no big deal. It's fine. But there's video of him saying, I've never set an arson fire except in training exercises.
Sure.
Okay.
I don't believe him, but okay.
There was also evidence that he planned some of the fires that occurred.
What?
Exactly. There were before and after videos. There was a hillside home of this beautiful brown house, if you watch it on Forensic Files.
Yes.
Beautiful brown house. And there was a video of it 18 months before a second video of it engulfed in flames and burning down during the fire. Which is funny because this video is shot and fire department was like coming onto the scene. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Orr was there at the scene of the fire before the fire department had been called.
Really?
Yeah. So now he has before footage and after footage, and they believe this isn't the only incident.
Because he, like, already knew where they were, so he'd be there first.
Yes. Well, he would have set the fire.
Yeah.
How else would he have gotten there so quickly? And why would you have footage of this house 18 random months places, before
yeah.
from the exact same angle?
Yeah.
So they believe that he took these before and after videos and sat and watched these fires while the fire department came on scene in order to relive the events later.
Yeah.
There's a manuscript for a book he wrote that was also recovered from his home.
Uh-oh.
This book was called Point of Origin, I think.
Okay.
And it was about a firefighter turned arsonist named Aaron Stiles. That's the character in the book.
Okay.
This character used delayed incendiary devices similar to those used in the cases.
I can't.
To set fires in retail stores and craft sections while on his way to and from arson conferences.
I can't, Winnie.
The character would also set multiple fires at the same time because when firefighters went to one fire, it gave them more time to sit and watch the second or third fire grow larger. There's a description of a Cal's hardware store in the novel where a boy named Matthew died in the fire. This boy in the story was the same age with the same name as the 2-year-old boy who died for real in the first fire.
I can't. Is he stupid? What did he say?
Writing a novel.
He was like, what, inspired by the fires?
Well, Aaron Stiles said, "It's not my fault. Stupid people acting how stupid people do. If they were better," basically, Aaron Stiles believed, "if they were better fire investigators and firefighters, then they would be able to put the fires out or figure out who it was and people wouldn't be getting hurt."
This guy is ridiculous.
So they weren't doing a good enough job, so we had to show them how bad they were at their job.
Right.
If he was in charge, he would be able to.
But he is an arson investigator. Like, in real life, that doesn't make any sense.
Throw your hands in the air like you just.
If they were better, like, what does he want? He wants to be an arson investigator in a different district? Like, is that what he wanted?
Well, he didn't think he deserved to be in Glendale. He thought he should be moved up in the ranks. But, listen, allegedly, this is Aaron Stiles saying this, not Mr. Orr.
Whatever.
But multiple fires in the book were eerily similar, not just the Matthew at Cal's Hardware.
Right.
To the fires that happened in real life.
Yeah.
They basically laid out his plan of when he had gone and staked out houses and places. And when he had gone back and set the fires and how he had watched them afterwards. And it was basically an autobiography of how he had done this.
Goodness gracious.
It was ridiculous.
Yeah, that's so stupid.
Joseph Wombaug. W-A-M-B-A-U-G-H.
Wombat. Okay, Joseph Wombaug.
He's an author who wrote a book about John Orr after all of these events. And he called it Fire Lover.
Okay.
He said that the person who best describes the psyche of an organized serial arsonist is John Orr himself. He says, quote, "the fire becomes a mistress, a lover," end quote. But in the...
He becomes, like, obsessed with it. Like, right. Watching it.
Yeah, becomes obsessed with the call of the fire.
Yeah.
And so Mr. Joseph Wombaug, however you say his name, it's not Wombat, but that's what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Says that he, from this quote by John Orr of The Fire Becomes a Mistress, a Lover, he got the title Fire Lover for his book that he wrote about these events.
Right. Interesting.
So a little bit about, like, the psyche and the psychiatry behind what was going on.
Okay.
Pyromania, which is what we would call this in this instant that Mr. Orr had. Yeah,
setting fires, or with fire.
Yes. It's a psychiatric diagnosis rather than a legal term. So that's why it's kind of gray in whether or not you can use this in court.
Okay.
Individuals with pyromania engage in intentional and pathological fire setting. they don't always commit arson, but they feel the need to start fires.
Right, but that could be like them just starting fires like in their backyard or whatever. It doesn't mean they're starting fires to burn things down.
Right. So a lot of arsonists might be pyromaniacs, but not all pyromaniacs are arsonists.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're looking at psychiatric criteria, you have to have like 1 out of 15 symptoms to actually call this a psychiatric disorder of fire-setting behavior or pyromania. We're not going to go through all of that. Okay. But it's like a psychiatric term.
Yeah.
It's not a legal term for what you're convicted of.
Yeah.
Basically.
That would be an arsonist.
Yes. pyromania itself is rare and a pathological disorder, and it's repeated fire setting. So like I said, you feel like you have to keep doing it.
Right.
You're deeply fascinated with fire and related to any fire paraphernalia. So you feel like you need things around that you could start fires with.
Okay.
And
that's why you carry around a briefcase with matches.
Right. And like souvenirs from your fires.
Yeah.
Some also say,
which would be like the book.
Exactly. And the videos of the house
videos,
and things.
Yeah.
These people may experience feelings of satisfaction or a sexual release of inner tension or anxiety that you feel like you have to set a fire. You get really anxious, you set a fire, and then you feel better. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's a list of a bunch of symptoms you can look it up of how you can diagnose somebody who has pyromania. The signs include excessive or unnecessary amount of matches or lighters. He had that. Burns holes in fabrics or rugs. I mean, he set craft stores on fire. Burnt pieces of paper or other material in garbage cans or near a sink or stove where they're just, like, lighting things on fire and then putting it out. Someone who has pyromania may seem obsessed with fire or firefighting. So they like to visit fire departments. They like to watch fires. They like to help out after a fire and try and be on the scene, even if they're not a firefighter themselves.
Yeah.
And they might even call false alarms to other fires or say there's a fire when there's not.
Okay.
So that's just, like, the psychiatric background behind what Mr. Orr may have had that led up to this. Although, legally, he was not considered, like, insane. It's not an insanity plea.
No, he's legal. Psychiatrically, he's considered a pyromaniac. Legally, he's considered an arsonist.
Yes. And he does have the psychological disorder, but it's not something where...
You can't get convicted for that. You have to be convicted as an arsonist.
Yes. And the whole point of them going through this was to say, listen, legally, he's an arsonist. Pyromania is not an excuse to plead insanity.
Right.
Like, you can't plead insanity just based
because
on pyromania.
Because pyromania, like you said, isn't someone who... Like, you're obsessed with fire, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're out to set fires to, like, kill people or burn things down.
Right. Absolutely. So, Mr. Orr was charged with numerous accounts of arson and the murder of the 4 people who died. He got life in prison without parole.
Nice.
Now, the most interesting thing about this to me was that afterwards, Mr. Casey and other arson investigators did an average of the number of fires. So, when they averaged the number of fires that were happening in the area prior to Mr. Orr's conviction and after, they went from 67 fires a year in the area of LA County to 1 a year.
Oh, gosh.
That was for the 10 years leading up to the conviction.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, so they dropped it.
Hey, I think they found the right guy.
I think so, too.
If it was, like, 67 to 65, I'd be like, okay, but 67 to 1, that's crazy.
So we probably talked about maybe 10 fires that he started, maybe not even.
Well, those might be, like, the big ones, too. There could have been ones that he...
those are the ones they could link him to,
right.
I think, from the book.
Yeah.
But they believe, the investigators believe Mr., the special agent, Matassa, and Mr. Casey believe that Mr. Orr may have set over 2,000 fires.
Like, how do you have time for that?
I don't know.
Oh my gosh. I guess it could have been little ones too that, like, didn't really go up in flames. Like, people found it and, you know what I mean?
Right. It didn't cause a whole store to burn down.
Yeah.
But it was, they're counting fires. I don't think it's like any time he started a campfire, they counted as a tally.
Yeah.
I think it's more of significant fires, but maybe not ones that they could link
to. So many, though.
It's so many.
Wow.
I know I gave a lot of background about, like, the burns and the pyromania, but to me that's what makes this interesting, to have the background of, you know, medically the different burns have changed. That's just interesting to me. But the pyromania, he couldn't plead insanity, even though it is a psychiatric diagnosis. Right. Because...
yeah, but pyromania is not like, you're insane. It's like, they just really like fire.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's not... you can't plead insanity with it. That's the whole point.
Right. Wow. Mm.
So, to me, this is crazy just because, you know, we have friends who lived in this area. These were such public places that were set on fire. And this person was writing a book about it with his alter ego.
Stupid.
And basically admitted to everything in this book. He had clues in there. He had information in there that was never released to the media.
Yeah.
And he was mad thinking that people weren't doing their job. And that's why... these fires were happening, even though he was setting them himself.
Yeah, hey, bud, if you would do your job, none of those fires would have happened, because you wouldn't have been starting them.
Yeah, yeah. So, what do you think? What are your thoughts? Will this keep you up at night, or will you still sleep as snug as a bug in a rug?
No, it's a little freaky, because to think that someone that's in charge of a fire department, you know what I mean? Someone mm-hmm. in charge of it is the one... starting it. I mean, I feel like that happens sometimes,
mm-hmm.
but it's just scary to think like nobody suspected him besides, you know, but not him specifically. Yeah. Nobody in his department would have thought, even though he's in charge and like running mm-hmm. their fire department, he's the one starting the fires.
And now looking back, they said that he was on the scene of most of these fires, and it was kind of strange that he was there so quickly, but at the time, you know, nobody knew. What's scary to me is that if he set in excess of 2,000 fires in his career, that's one person.
Yeah.
You know, and he's not the only arsonist in California, right. I can guarantee.
That's crazy. That's wild.
That's crazy, girl. I swear.
There's so much stuff in this.
It's a salad.
Yeah.
You want me to salad.
Why? Because you hungry.
You hungry.
Your mama says you hungry.
We say Hillshire. You say farm. Hillshire.
Farm.
Go meat. Throwback. So, anyway, I had this on my mind. We've watched the Forensic Files episode, but
I
also
forgot a lot about it.
The fires in Australia.
Yeah.
And, you know, LA always has a lot of fires. The whole California, that's been a problem for them in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
So this stood out in my mind because, you know, we have all these natural fires happening or ones that are accidental by people here and there.
So we don't need people starting any.
We don't need people starting fires to craft stores.
Yeah.
What did the craft section ever do to you?
Yeah, why do you pick craft stores all the time? Like,
and I don't know. I don't know what his reason for that was.
Maybe he just knew that the foam was flammable. So he was just like, I'm going to pick this because it's...
And I think that was part of it. I'd be interested to see, and I haven't looked, whether his book was ever actually turned into a book.
There's no way.
I don't know.
Unless they sold it. The only way that would be okay is if the profits went to, like, the families who...
Yeah, I mean, but it's his intellectual property. I mean, he could.
I guess he could get it published, huh?
Yeah.
Well, if it was confiscated, he'd have to probably rewrite it, right? Because it was confiscated as evidence. Does he get that back?
I don't know. I don't know. That's the thing that I think I'm going to be wondering the most about.
Yeah.
Is whether or not. Now, if you want to watch the Forensic Files episode, it's called Point of Origin.
Yeah.
Which is also the title of his book. Mm. Not the title of the book about him. That's Fire Lover.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, I will attach my references other than the Forensic Files link because you could find it.
It's on Netflix.
If you look it up, it says Series 9, Episode 21, but on Netflix, it's Collection 2, Episode 4.
Yeah.
So who knows?
Who knows? But if you want to look at our resources, they'll be on our website, buginarug.podbean.com. You can look those up. Let us know what Forensic Files episode you like, and we'll watch it. We'll talk about it.
We've been really into it lately, and if there's,
there's so many. Yeah, like we'll mention it. If you have a one that you think we should watch, they're not that long, so we'll watch it, and then we'll mention it in the next podcast. You can suggest some to us at our email, biarpodcast@gmail.com, our Twitter or Instagram. Or Facebook, Twitter and Instagram are at BIAR Podcast. Facebook, just search Bug in a Rug. You'll find our page. I think that's everything, right?
Guys, we have so many stickers right now.
Yeah,
so many stickers. I really love to give you a sticker.
Yeah.
I need to give you a sticker.
Yeah.
I need to.
We'll do another promotion.
I need to give you a sticker like John Orr needs to set fires.
Oh.
Maybe not that badly, oh, but...
No. Like, Marvin Casey needs to convince people that he knows who did it.
Yes, I have a strong urge. In the back of my mind, I know without a doubt that you need a sticker.
Yeah.
And that you have been to an arsonist convention where you need a sticker.
Arsonist convention. Gosh, have you ever been to an arsonist convention? Let us know.
Investigator convention. Ugh.
Yeah, to get a sticker, just rate us on Facebook or iTunes and screenshot it and send it to us at any of those things that I just mentioned.
Yeah, and then we'll mail it to you. It's free.
Yeah.
Free sticker.
Yeah, or, you know, just reach out to us. Hit us up. Suggest anything to us.
We still have a couple suggestions.
Oh, I just want to say that Carly texted me the other day because she listened to our Mary Lude episode and she got to Dad's poem and she thought it was the funniest thing ever.
Dad feels really bad about the poem.
No, it's fine. It was fine.
We still have a couple suggestions that we're working on getting out there.
Yes.
I know, Hunter, you had suggested a couple things I won't say out loud because I don't want to spoil it for people who don't know.
Right, right.
But we will get to those soon. We have to coordinate schedules with a couple guests, special guests that we want to have.
Because basically our dad suggested the same thing, right?
He suggested something very similar from the
same
area.
So we were
going
to put them together. So we wanted him to come on.
Big old combo episode about Preston County, West Virginia.
Yeah,
look
so
out,
we're working out, on out. It. So it'll be coming up. Yes.
That's all I have.
That's all I have.
Listen, Mom's going to listen to this episode and be like, Whitney really likes it when she's in charge of the fire. But Mom says she worries about it. That's the only fires I start.
Yeah.
That I know fires. Of. That you know of. That I know of, too. So I'm going to go to an arsonist convention.
Learn how to start more fires.
Alrighty. Anyway, fire safety's not a joke, folks.
Yeah, seriously.
We're gonna actually have a fire drill when we got up here.
Plan with your children or your parents.
Whoever you live with.
Yeah.
You should have a fire safety plan.
If there's a fire, how do you get out of your apartment and where to meet?
Also.
And if you have pets, how to get them out.
Yes, and I think it's really important to note, I have these stickers, you can buy them on Amazon, and it says, in case of a fire, please save my blank. So I have it on the outside of our apartment door, and it says, in case of a fire, please save my two cats. So you can put how many that you have. I know Greg's not on there.
I need one. I'll put one fish.
And one fish.
Write it in Sharpie down below.
Do you think the firefighters will stop and save Greg?
No.
But they'll save a cat? That seems really sad.
I think they will if they can find them. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, if it's safe and they're not putting themselves at risk.
Yeah.
Did you think this episode was pretty hot?
Okay. I'm signing off now.
We hope that you guys enjoyed this episode and that it won't keep you up at night and you're still able to sleep as snug as a bug in a very warm, toasty, but not on fire rug.
Signing off. My name's Caitlin.
Wait a minute.
Oh, God. What?
I forgot a poem.
You have a poem?
I have a quote. I have a quote. I have a quote. I have a quote. It's not a poem.
Okay.
Rewind. Stop. Stop. Rewind.
Stop. Pause. Hammer time.
Play. I have a quote for you.
Okay.
Now, I found this quote because I was trying to find a poem. Couldn't find a poem that I liked.
Okay.
But I found a quote about love and fire from Joan Crawford, who I think she was an actress. I don't remember. Mm. But it said that love is like a fire, but you never know whether it will warm your hearth or burn down your house. You just never know.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think fire is like love.
Think about.
You never know whether it'll keep you warm or break your heart. It can break your heart.
Okay. That's it
Somebody
for now.
911.
Okay.
Shorty fire burning on the
Signing off. Floor. My name's Caitlin.
And I'm Whitney.
Bye.
Sleep tight.